You're tuned to WPKN in Bridgeport, 89.5 FM, listener-supported radio. And welcome to the Emotion Roadmap. And Chuck, take it away.
Welcome. It's nice to be back with you all this month, and I want to talk to you about what the show is about. I want to talk to you what we're going to be doing today, and I want to talk a little bit about what we've been doing in the past. The show is the Emotion Roadmap. Take the wheel and control how you feel. If you want to email, you can email me at cjwolfe@cjwolfe.com. Please call and write in for ideas about the show. The show is all about helping you to manage your emotions, helping you with your emotional relationships with other people. Most of us feel that the emotional part of our lives pretty much operate independently of our rational minds. But this show is all about how to take control. The show is about being able to create the feelings that you want. One of the things that I encourage you to think about is, if you're not feeling the way you want, is to ask yourself, what would be more ideal to feel? That key question, what would be more ideal to feel, reflects the way I addressed this show and all the topical areas in it. This afternoon, we're going to be talking with two people, Jay Vadavelu and Lou Ma, who is a graduate student of Jay's. Jay is a senior consulting actuary in the Towers Watson Risk and Financial Services Practice in Hartford. And he's also the Towers Watson Professor at the University of Connecticut, where he manages the newly endowed Janet and Mark L. Goldenson Center for Actuarial Research. He has his doctorate in statistics from the University of California, Berkeley, is a fellow of the Society of Actuaries, a member of the American Academy of Actuaries, a chartered financial analyst. Jay has over 25 years' experience with the life insurance industry, which also includes senior-level appointments at Connecticut Mutual, Mass Mutual, Aetna Financial Services, ING, Deloitte Consulting, and most recently, Watson Wyatt. Now, along with Jay today, we have his graduate student, Lou Ma. Lou Ma is a graduate student at the University of Connecticut, pursuing a master's degree in actuarial science. Lou has a bachelor's degree in engineering and worked in the financial service industry for over a year before entering into the field of actuarial science last fall. Since then, Lou has had several actuarial science internships, from working for large insurance corporations like United Healthcare and Cigna. Lou, together with three other graduate students in actuarial science, was selected by the Golden Center and actuarial research at the University of Connecticut to do a risk management project for a couple of small businesses in the region. And today we're going to talk a little bit first about enterprise risk management. I'm going to initially just ask Jay to say a little bit about his role both with Towers Watson and with the University of Connecticut, talk about the center, and talk about the role of graduate students in this program. It's all very interesting, and I think it'll be a good way to begin to understand how he's involved with small businesses with this idea of enterprise risk management. So, Jay, if you would, could you tell us a little bit about you and about Lou and the center?
Yes, you described it well. I am the director of the center, and I'm also a professor. And I have this job with Towers Watson. They actually fund my professorship at the university, so that's how it all connects. The center is something that has been around for maybe close to 10 years, but it only got funded about 2 years ago, and that came from this gift from the Goldenson family. And the funding meant a lot to me. Number one, I had money, and that also meant that I could support students like Lou on projects. My role in the center is it's pretty much up to me. I pursue interesting projects that I think are valuable, and I I do research work. I work with companies. I have an advisory board which involves most of the companies in the region. And Towers Watson, I do consulting work for them, and many times the work I consult in is related to the R&D I do at the center.
Okay, and you tell us how you use students in the process.
Well, the whole, so almost the mission statement of the center is to do applied research by partnering academicians, students, and faculty with industry people, because I think that combination is lethal.
Lethal being in a good way.
Of course, very good.
Okay, so when you are able to attract students, and students that come on board know that they're going to have this opportunity to work in industry and not just learn in a laboratory, in theory, and have a chance to actually practice
Yes.
I think that's pretty unique in your world, or is this somewhat typical other places?
In my world, actually, the actuarial profession is a little bit different, I think, because actuarial students often get internships in summer, but they really start to learn about, you know, the field when they graduate and they start to work in a company. I kind of look at what I'm trying to do here is not making it a sequential type approach. So while they are students, they can learn what it is like to work in real life, real projects. And these are like from start to finish projects, which when we get into the ERM for small businesses, I'll describe it to you.
Okay, so you have, again, I think it's a little unique that you have a position with a consulting firm.
Yes.
And also have a professorship as well as run a center at a university.
Yes, that absolutely. I think I might be the only one I know who's got this dual arrangement, but Towers Watson has been extremely supportive of my role.
Okay, and Towers Watson benefits because they get new product ideas. They get some initiatives that they possibly would have to fund some other way if they weren't coming through the center.
Yes. Yes, and they also, you know, have a chance to screen very good students, but unfortunately, Lou has been taken by another company.
Okay, well, Lou, maybe this will be a chance for you to tell us a little bit about yourself and how you happen to, want to go to this program and what the experience has been. If you could just tell us a little bit about your background with the program, I'd appreciate it.
Yeah, sure. So I actually graduated from UConn with an engineering degree. I never thought I would become an actuary or do any sort of project that we're going to be talking about today. But after entering the workforce, I quickly discovered that with my personality and just my passion align more with the business world, and UConn certainly has a very, very good actuarial science program. That's why I decided to, you know, return to school and sort of, get myself into the field of actuarial science. And I was very lucky that Professor Redivelu was my professor since the very first semester that I was at UConn. And he was always the kind of professor that emphasized not only on the theories and the formulas and all the boring math that we learn in his class. Sorry.
Not a true actuary, I can see that. Okay.
he always told us, you know, even during lectures, he would say, this is what the book says, but in the real world, this is what we would do. So from the very beginning, I knew that he would become a very special professor and a mentor in a way for me. And when he presented this opportunity for me to get involved in this enterprise risk management for a small business, I jumped on the ship as quickly as I could because it sounded like a very, very exciting opportunity. And, you know, both personally and professionally, just a very, very good chance for me to develop. And I definitely learned a lot from this project.
Well, thank you, Lou. And I'd like to get back to Jay here and talk a little bit about the fact that Jay's someone I know, by the way, just from we found each other on a racquetball court one day together, and we've been playing racquetball for a couple of years together, and we just seem to find a lot to talk about when the game's over. And I found Jay filled with lots of ideas. This is a particularly interesting one where there's a blend of what I talk about on this show and what Jay does. If we think about being in a small business and think about the fact that a lot of small businesses are, just like the rest of the economy, struggling a bit these days. But maybe you've got a success story and you've been doing things a certain way for a long period of time, and you're beginning to think that, you know what, I'm not sure I can continue to make it just doing things the way I've always done them. And so, Jay, if you could tell us a little bit now about this idea of enterprise risk management and how it fits. And one of the ways I like to think about, kind of extending what I do to what Jay does is to think about emotionally, it's hard for people to change, especially when they think about, you know I can't keep doing things the way I've been doing them, but I'm comfortable, I've been successful, I know who I am, I know what I can do, I know how to do it this way. And now if I ask somebody to come in and I pay them some money or even just give them a lot of time, even if it's for free, and it's a really solid, sound recommendation, but it's not something I'm comfortable with, and it's not something I know how to do. Do I have to keep paying? Do I have to hire somebody else? I mean, how do I move forward on these recommendations? So there's a lot of fear in the very beginning about even approaching this. So if you could tell us a little bit about enterprise risk management for big business, and then tell us how you thought about it for small business.
Yes, I'm going to use the word ERM. That's enterprise risk management. It's almost the terminology everyone talks about. So ERM for large corporations, I mean, there are books written on it. You can get your PhD in ERM, and it's largely geared towards large corporations. And large corporations, I mean, it's as I said, a very hot topic, and they're certainly willing to pay and devote a lot of resources on risk management. But think about a large corporation. They may call it enterprise risk management now, but there are so many departments in a large corporation, like internal audit, for example, or corporate, or investor services, or investor relations. They are always doing risk management in any case. So risk management has been part and parcel of the culture of large corporations. And then enterprise risk management, now they have separate departments and they have chief risk officers and so on. But as you might well imagine, doing risk management for a large corporation in many lines of businesses is very complicated, and modeling is complicated, and it's not clear after all the work that goes on whether it's being used or whether it's not, it's changed the culture. Now you swing to small businesses and you get a completely different sort of story. And, you know, risk is, I mean, small businesses are always exposed to risk. They're always dealing with risk, but it's never been done in this formal way. And in fact, if you look at literature, you know, if you just do any kind of an internet search for enterprise risk management for small businesses, there's virtually nothing in there. And if anything, it'll direct you for ERM for large businesses. So there's nothing formal that's being done for small businesses. And of course, the question is why? I mean, and now I decided to delve into it partly because no one else was doing any work and I have a small budget and I could actually fund it and not charge the small business you know, anything. And of course, I've got students like Lou and others who are very good.
And this is partly because of the university connection,
yes,
right? Where
yes,
the everybody benefits because you've got a funding source,
yes,
and the
yes,
students are learning, small
yes,
business people are learning, and
yes,
and potentially you have a marketplace if you create a product and a template that will guide small businesses on looking at holistically at their business.
Right, right, right. So one of the things I learned as I was, you know, talking to small businesses and working with them, obviously, you know, there's a very obvious reason that, you know, if they're going to pay for something, they're more likely pay for something which generates revenue or cut costs.
Right.
And they wouldn't think of risk as something that's so important because, you know, you could do all that and your business could collapse because you missed something really big. So the idea of paying for something is possibly one reason. But despite that, when we were, you know, working with the students and we were calling small businesses, not everyone was willing to accept this free service, which is very interesting. And then even with the different businesses we have worked with, those who went through the exercise, not everyone responded the same way. So I, you know, having talked to you a little bit about emotional intelligence and things you work on, it also could be that, you know, some of the things you mentioned, fear of change, or obviously, at the end of a risk management analysis, we come up with recommendations and suggestions. And some of that could be that, you know, the way they were doing something, you know, may not be strategically correct, and they might need to do some major changes to their operations. And that is not something that someone who's been in business for several years and managing is that ready to do.
It's interesting that people turned you down, even though it's a free service. And one of the things that struck me, having known a lot of small businessmen in my life, is that some people feel like, you know what, they've got a formula that works and they're afraid to tell anybody else,
yes,
about it. And so while you might promise confidentiality, you've got a group of students that,
yes,
are coming in and seeing what they do, and you're learning their little tricks and secrets that make them successful, they think. And they may be fearful of that as well.
Maybe. And in fact, when Lou goes through, you know, some of the case studies, almost diametrically different, different clients who work. Some of them are very willing to share, particularly financial information, and some of them are not. And so, how do you then still do a decent study, you know, with limited information? And that was itself a learning process. But the one thing I found, okay, when you find a small business that's willing to work with you, in contrast to large businesses, you know, the first mistake that you should avoid is thinking that you know how to tell the small business person how to run their business. You know, they know their business intimately. They know exactly what needs to be done, and they're actually even aware of their risks. In fact, we get all this information from them. I mean, they have problems, they'll tell you, the ones who are open. So they know their business and they're aware of their risks, but doing something about it and putting it as a priority is another story. So they know their business. And and the other thing, too, is when you actually work with a small business, in contrast to a large corporation, there are risks, but you can put your arms around the risks. In contrast to a huge company where there's, you know, many lines of business, many product lines, all kinds of, you know, of potential risks. With a small business, you can put your arms around the risk and you can actually make some decent suggestions that can make a difference. So that was a very gratifying experience for myself and the students, that you can actually make an impact.
Well, when you think about this, you know, I'm struck by, you know, having worked in large organizations, mm-hmm. too, you have an entire marketing department that's focused on marketing,
yes.
an entire public relations department that's uh-huh. focused on that, an entire investment relations department that's all these pieces. If a chief risk officer has an idea, he's got somebody he can
yes.
push towards that.
Yes.
If you're a small business owner and you say, gee, I wonder if I should be doing more around my brand and my image,
yes.
or if I should be doing more on customer retention, or I should be doing more on new product, and all of a sudden you're overwhelmed with all mm-hmm. the possibilities of what mm-hmm. you could. So it seems to me anybody would welcome another set of eyes, good critical thinkers coming in, taking a look at this. But I think one of the things that they would ask would be, what's your approach? How do you understand my whole business and whether or not I should be spending time in all these various areas? What do you view as the approach that you could say, this is the way we define enterprise risk management for the small business person?
And actually, I mean, for the small business person, well, you raise a very good point in terms of, you know, a large corporation, all these activities are all spread out with different departments. Well, in a small business, it's very concentrated. The risks are all, you know, pretty obvious to see in many cases. But the one thing I learned about doing risk management for a small business, in contrast to a large corporation, usually in a large corporation, risk management is well defined, as it can be. But then business growth is usually relegated to, say, the sales marketing area. For a small business, when you talk of risk and growth, they are one and the same thing. You can manage all your risks, but if you're not growing, you know, you don't have a business. So what we usually try to do as we talk about risks, we talk about things that will help the business grow, be competitive. And these things resonate well with a small business. So, you know, if they say they want to be like this, but they have, say, a website which is really outdated, or you know, if you enter the business and it doesn't look appealing, those are things that, you know, we bring to the attention. So I think because we talk of business growth and risk, the whole complete package becomes sort of more palatable than if you just talked about, you know, gee, what if you have a terrorist attack? You know, it doesn't mean much to them.
Okay. I remember one time I was doing some consulting for a group, and they were... And again, this is where it gets complicated, because mm-hmm. they were concerned about growth, like a lot of companies.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a healthcare business, and they hired a chief executive officer after many, many months who had a reputation for being able to grow a company like theirs.
Mm-hmm.
This person came in and was amazing, but he didn't know how to stop and build the infrastructure to support that growth, and so they crumbled. At
mm-hmm.
some point, he just kept building new and more customers, and the infrastructure that was there couldn't support it. So I guess you have to balance growth with
yes.
all the other issues that are impacted by in a business setting.
You raise a very good point, because actually I was, you know, if you go to the internet, they'll give you the 10 top reasons why small businesses fail. Now, why a business fails, and that being a risk you should, you know, manage, one and the same thing. And growing too fast is one reason why businesses fail.
Right.
And it could be for the very reason you described. The other things are like maybe mundane things you never think about, like, you know, you're growing your business, you're selling, and, you know, the money's coming in, but you can't track it. So you really don't know where your money's coming from. And you know, I don't think that you should inundate, you know, small businesses with a lot of information, but basic tracking as to where you're making your money and where you should concentrate your energies on, sometimes that's all we might end up doing as something very tangible besides some of the qualitative suggestions. Give them a little spreadsheet model they can work with, and that has an impact.
So the idea of giving them a few tools, some simple things they may not think about, some things that you've learned. And I imagine as you go from one business to the other, I know for myself as I've worked in different companies, you know, it isn't just me educating a company. I'm also learning every time I go into someplace new. I'm learning what some companies do that is just outstanding that I've never seen before, and I'm taking that knowledge with me every time I go to another client. And each time I go to a client, it's often an exchange. I'm giving something they don't know, and they're learning, and I'm helping them with their executive coaching or team building or helping them with change or something like that. But at the same time, every time I'm in, I'm learning about how a group of people is trying to make success happen. And sometimes some of those things that I'm learning are great and can be transferred to other places. Yeah.
Well, I'll tell you, Chuck, one of the things when I have the students working with me, I sort of stand sort of from a distance and I guide them. But one of the first things I tell them is, you know, when we first choose a small business and they agree to do this analysis, before we meet with them, students do a lot of research on the business and similar businesses to learn as much as they can about the business. And the most important thing they do when they meet with the client or the owner typically is to listen. So the students work in teams. So, you know, if one is asking a question or talking, there's someone taking notes. So the listening is the most important thing, because most of us don't know anything about the businesses that we are doing this risk management about. But risk is still, you know, something that cuts across every type of business. But you have to understand the unique nature of the business and some of the priorities of these risks. So one risk could be a big priority for one business, but not for the other.
Why actuaries doing this? Why isn't this happening? Why isn't the MBA programs in different universities doing enterprise risk management for small businesses? What makes an actuary a successful candidate for this kind of work?
Well, first of all, other departments, particularly business schools, do have enterprise risk management programs. Now, I obviously have the research center, so there's a natural tendency for me to be biased towards the actuarial students. But, you know, the actuarial profession is changing. And the younger generation I've seen who have joined the program are just more innovative and creative in their thinking. But the technical skills that actuaries have is actually very valuable in doing any kind of analysis, even though for a small business, you know, you have to think out of the box. You know, you have to adapt your solution for each business uniquely. Still, fundamental concept of risk, how do you model risk, how do you quantify risk? Actuaries are very good at it because, you know, they're constantly dealing with risks that go many years into the future. Business students are possibly very good in terms of conceptualizing things. In fact, as I've been developing this program, I think the next round of projects I'll be doing, I'm going to partner the actual students with the business students. I think that'll be a dynamic partnership.
That's great. So that's another interesting idea. But at the moment, you're doing this with actuaries.
With actual students, yes.
Right. And also that I do want to say a little bit about this idea that if people are interested in working with you, because as people are listening, they may be curious about, okay, so I'm listening to Jay talk about enterprise risk management for my business. And what would be the kind of criteria that you would consider for someone who might want to work with your center to actually have people come in and look at what they do?
I tend to focus on like the 5 to 20 small business that size, and I like to look at small businesses that have been around for a few years, so they have a bit of a track record versus a startup company. Not that I would turn down a startup company, but a startup company, there are other issues to deal with, and again, you don't have a track record. It's ideal to see a company that's been around and doing decently for several years and now analyzing ways in which it can change and avoid failure in the future.
What would be your criteria for saying we had a successful intervention?
Okay, successful intervention would be number one is the client or the business owner opening up their business to me and the students, so willing to share information. So the first thing is they to believe and they are looking for help. So that's very important. And ultimate success is that whatever we put together a formal report at the end, and if there are any software tools that comes with the report, at the end of it all, if there are two or three things that had come out of this whole study that allows someone to do something differently and improve, and, you know, I said this is the person who's receiving this information, two or three individuals, and they come right up to you and tell you how much they learned from it. So the success is immediate. You don't have to guess because, you know, we present it. You know, students do a PowerPoint presentation at the end of the project, and, you know, the client is right there in front of you and, you know, telling you how much they appreciated it.
So the idea of somebody being very thankful and appreciative of something you've given them, and then
and using it. Absolutely. Right, right. Using it is the most important thing.
Right. Okay, well, thank you. Now, I'd like to move back now and talk a little bit about actually a case study. So if you don't mind, Jay, just tell me how you got the case, and then Lou, you take it from there about what you did as a student and with the team.
the way we got the case, we try to work with small businesses around the stores area. That's where the university is. So, you know, we literally looked up businesses that are listed, and this one business, it's a small bagel chain, and Lou will talk about it. We just called them. I usually have an email, a nicely written email that I forward to the owner and explain to them what we're trying to do. And they responded that they were interested. And they were actually very interested.
Okay, so I worked with three other classmates on two different projects for the last semester. Now, the first one I like to go into is with a bagel shop called Between Rounds Bagels. They're located in Vernon, Connecticut area. They became a business in 1990. They're owned by a couple named Jerry and Lori, along with Jerry's brother Joe. Now, ever since they started their first store in Vernon, they also opened up two more locations in South Windsor and Manchester area. Now, how we found this place is just like Professor Vedavello described before. We literally Googled small businesses around stores area and just start cold calling everybody, offered them our services, explained what we can offer, and they were one of the first ones to respond. And that's basically how we got to do this project for them. Now, in terms of what happened with the project, one of the first things that we did is we went for a face-to-face interview. Now, this is generally the general approach we would take with any small business. So a group of us went for a face-to-face interview with the owners of Between Rounds. We obviously came with a list of questions that we think would spark some ideas and would sort of get them start talking about the risks that they see now or the potential risks that they think they might have but can't quite conceptualize it or can't quite quantify them themselves. Now, after this during the initial interview, we were very lucky that the owners of Between Rounds were very, very open-minded and very cooperative during the entire process. They were willing to share with us all kinds of data from their income statement to the very detailed daily sales record. Okay, that was definitely a very, very pleasant surprise because, like what we mentioned earlier in the show, a lot of times these small business owners, they're not willing to give up these information. They feel like those are their secrets. That's what makes them successful. But luckily, these owners were very cooperative, and that definitely made our jobs very, very, or I would say a lot easier. So after we got all of the data from the owners, what we did is we sort of looked at their business from two different perspectives. Now, we are actuarial students. We love math. So we definitely looked at all the data and analyzed them from a quantitative perspective. But we also can't forget that, you know, numbers don't tell you the full story. So we also try to look at small business on a qualitative perspective. So those are the two general perspectives we would take for any small business. For this particular case, on the quantitative level, we sort of looked at the data from two different levels. On a very high level, we looked at their past 5 years' income statement, and we were sort of trying to identify trends. You know, during what month of the year do they sell the best? What kind of items do they sell the best? Is there significant differences in terms of profits between all three different locations? Now, why is that? So after looking through the past 5-year data from that high level, we were able to identify some very useful seasonal trends. Now, that's math. But you have all these beautiful graphs and beautiful numbers, and then what? What do you do with them? So based on those number results, we then would recommend, you know, some qualitative recommendations to help their business. So just to give you a very brief example, based on the numbers and the analysis that we did, we realized that usually during the first few months of the year, their sales go down. So usually during January into February, for some reason, their sales are just not as good as the rest of the year. So we put our brains together. We thought about it. It must be due to New Year's resolution. Because at the end of the year, everybody wants to lose weight. Everybody tries to stay away from bagels and donuts and things like that. And that made sense to us. And when we communicated this to the owners, you know, a light bulb sort of went off in their brain as well. So then from that, based on what we thought of, one idea we came up with is, hey, why don't you run a healthy promotion during those months? Why don't you introduce a whole wheat bagel? Why don't you introduce non-fat yogurt during those 2 months as an additional breakfast item? Why don't you make the unhealthy stuff a little bit cheaper during those few months? So they really like that, but that's just a very small example of one of the recommendations that we came up with based on the number analysis.
That's very concrete. Luke, could I ask you just a couple of questions about what you've said so far?
Absolutely.
You say that you come in with a few questions to spark interest. Can you think of any of those questions, a couple that maybe things that you might typically say to a small business owner that might be of interest to anybody that might be listening out there?
Sure. So I would say we usually start off, like Professor Vedvelo said, before we went into the interview, we Googled, you know, the surrounding bagel shops, and we tried to learn as much as possible about the bagel industry.
Great.
But usually what we do is we let them give us a brief introductory of their history, of how they became a business. And one of the key questions that we tend to ask is, have you had any failures? What are the major failures or the mistakes that you've made in the past years? Give us very specific, very concrete examples. And based on the examples, then they tell us there's usually a pattern. There's usually a pattern of the mistakes that they tend to make. And based on that, we can pick that up from the conversation and then go from there. So those are just some of the opening questions that we would start
Interesting.
With.
So by asking about failure, you force them to look at issues that they may want to address.
Yes.
Do you also ask about successes?
Yes, absolutely. We also ask them, hey, what makes you a successful business? You know, what makes you different from other bagel shops in the area, in this particular example? And whatever they tell us, you know, that's also a focus point of our project, because they think that's what makes them successful, but is that really true? Because it's also very dangerous for someone to think that, hey, this is what makes me very successful, but after our after our analysis, it turns out, hey, that's actually not what makes you successful. It's something else. So that's also something that we definitely address during our interview.
Now, one of the things that I know from the business I'm in is that most people are comfortable talking about their successes.
Yes.
Not to the same degree. Some people are way too comfortable. But most people will tell you about why they think they're being successful.
Right.
The other question you ask is a little more threatening. And
right.
To ask why you might be feeling or failures you've had in the past, that's a little tougher necessarily for people. And also, if you're talking to three people in the room,
mm-hmm.
they're looking at each other as to who is the reason behind the failure.
So, yes, absolutely.
So how do you anticipate or deal with sometimes the difficulty in talking about failures and people maybe placing blame or looking at one another,
mm-hmm.
or just some things that, at least for me, are subtle cues saying, perhaps the failure is this person didn't listen to that person during that time frame or something like that.
Okay. So I would say the way we deal with that is, obviously when we go in, we know that we're going to get different reactions. And based on my experience and the projects I've done, I've definitely gotten very, very different reactions from business owners. You're absolutely right. Some of them are very open to tell us their mistakes and failures, and some of them are not. So how we deal with that is we go in and we make our position very clear. We say to them that we're just a group of university students. We're here to help you. We're not your competitors. We're not trying to figure out, you know, what your mistakes are and use those against you. You know, we make them feel very comfortable, and we say that the more information you can tell us, the more about the mistakes you've made in the past that you can tell us, the more we can help you, and the more and the higher of a chance that you won't fail in the future.
It seems to me, when you're asking those kind of questions, years ago I used to be a therapist,
right?
And you have to engender a level of trust that's
right.
pretty significant, actually.
Yeah.
And so one question for you is, had you ever thought about the fact that you have to make these people believe that as university students, you're really not going to be telling competitors about this, that somebody isn't secretly thinking of opening up a bagel shop? Or,
right, right.
And because... You know, if you're coming and talking to me,
right.
I want to believe you, but
right.
I've in the past had people tell me things that sounded right. very convincing and they weren't true.
Right. So I would say how we deal with that is we have, before we go in, we have these very official letters and things like that from Professor Vedavelu from the center that definitely show how credible we are. We are indeed university students. And you know, when we talk to them, one of the first things we say is that whatever the content of the conversation that we talk about today is strictly confidential. Unless you tell us that we can, you know, use this in our future studies, we won't mention anything. We won't mention your names. We won't mention any of the results we've found. So that's another way of sort of building that trust that you're talking about.
Now, that's interesting, though. Now, one of the things that you have done is you have mentioned the owners of this bagel shop.
Yeah.
And so I know that Jay has told me that you've got permission for that. I just want to
yes.
reiterate for anybody that's listening that this was all cleared ahead of time.
Yes, yes,
right.
definitely.
So now you come up with some recommendations. And again, you're looking at the data, and certainly an actuary could understand financial matters better than most anybody else.
Yes.
So that you've got that background. Now, what about this whole rest of it? Like, are you operating as efficiently as you might? Are there other bagel shops doing, is there a process to get the bagel over to the store quicker, faster, better?
Right.
Are they tracking inventory
yeah.
in a way that, you know, you have just in time this fresh group of bagels coming in for the person who wants to get a particular kind of bagel?
Yeah.
So there's a lot more than just looking at the trends and the financial implications.
Absolutely.
So you've got marketing, brand, I mean, all that stuff. How do you address the rest of that along the way?
Sure. So the example that I went into about their financial data is just one aspect of the project and of the recommendations that we came up with. The other aspect, for example, is they have a large number of very detailed sales records, daily sales records, literally how many plain bagels I sold today, how many, you know, cups of coffee I sold today. But, you know, they've had that information for years, but they never knew what to do with them. Because there's just thousands and thousands of data, and it's just stored in a computer, and they don't know what to do with it. It's very messy to deal with. So then what we did with those information is that we actually built a very simple Excel template that looked through all of these records, and we discovered that, you know, 50% or more than 50% of their profit is actually only coming from a very small percentage of the menu items. So that's also a very interesting discovery for the owners as well, is that, hey, are you focusing your energies and resources on the right items? Perhaps you should shrink your menu. Perhaps you should come up with a menu that just has the best sellers, because apparently not 100% of the stuff that's on the menu is contributing to the 100% of your profit. And at the end of the project, after we presented our findings, we also left them with the Excel model that we built, and we taught them how to use it. Now, when we build it, obviously, you know, we could throw in all these fancy functions and programming features, but, you know, we try to make it very simple, very easy to use, and we definitely made sure to teach them how to use it. And going forward, they can use this very simple tool as a tracking tool to track their performances and then to find out, you know, areas that are inefficient and things like that. And also another good thing that came out of that is Between Rounds is considering starting up a driving through. In fact, they recently did start up a driving through, and that's something new that they're trying out. But the frustrating part about that is they didn't know what to put on the driving through menu. Because again, they never went through this type of analysis. They have an idea of, okay, I think this is my best seller. But do you have anything to back it up? No, you don't. That's just a hunch that you have. So based on our analysis, we were actually able to recommend the stuff that you should be putting on the drive-through menu such that you do make a good profit, such that it is stuff that's quick to make so you don't hold up traffic in the drive-through area. So that's another very, you know, in my mind, very qualitative things that came out of that. And as college students, you know, they did mention to us that they are trying to attract younger crowds because, you know, we tend to stop by and get coffee and bagel on the way to school and what have you. So when we went into their shops, we did look at the image of their shops, you know, the kind of decor and things like that they have. And just based on, because of our age and our generation, and those are some of the other recommendations that we also recommended to the owners. We also told them to start a Facebook page. You know, Facebook is something that we use every day. I'm sure a lot of my peers out there, they probably check Facebook more often than they check their emails. So that's another very effective and free way to advertise your business that not all business owners may be aware of.
Okay, well, you know what, Jay, I was going to ask if you wanted to just talk a little bit about what is your role in overseeing a project like this? When do the people come and talk to you, and do you get involved in, with the customer at all, or are you just pretty much in the background on this? How do you play a role in this?
Well, I see this, at least with Lou and the three other students, I see them twice a week. So the students, I see them right after class. We'll always discuss, you know, this project. Initially, I had the students, and by the way, Chuck, it varies by the type of students. I had this dynamic bunch of students, so I said, look, if they are good, let them just go ahead and do it. So I think they had all the initial meetings with the students, with the owner, because, for example, the bagel place was close to where I live. I didn't make a quick trip over there to introduce myself, but I did that separately. I was there when we did the formal presentation at the end to talk to them, and I also communicated them to get their permission to talk about them in this show. So I stay away in terms of the direct dealings with the owner, but I do talk with the students after class just to get an overview of what they're doing and where they're going. And, you know, like you know, Lou was talking about the data and having to work with the data. I mean, the end result was great, but it took a lot of work, and you know, it was frustrating. And part of my job is to keep them going. And the bagel place was a wonderful, you know, client to deal with. We had another client which was difficult. It was very hard to get them to share information, and they weren't as cooperative. And of course, the students, you know, were getting very down on this project. And part of my job is sort of cheer them up and also let them know that this is real life. Not every small business is going to have the same kind of a personality. But they ended up doing a pretty decent job for the other project as well, to work around this difficult client.
So you're helping to, in some ways, mentor and guide as they go through the experience.
Absolutely.
Now, it's interesting because I think sometimes, you know, having been part of consulting firms, been a purchaser of consulting services when I worked in a large company, been a small businessman myself, one of the things that strikes me is that oftentimes a senior person like yourself comes in to sell the job, and then you get young people in to do the work. Uh-huh. And sometimes people feel cheated.
Uh-huh.
Now, Lou, you seem pretty exceptional with this stuff, and it seems like your enthusiasm would be catchy, and my guess is it follows you, and so maybe it's easier for you than it might be for some others. But still, you're coming in, you don't have a lot of experience, you know, you've got good intentions, you're a smart person, that would be clear to people, you have a lot of energy, but am I going to be wasting my mm-hmm. time educating you as we go through mm-hmm. this process as opposed to what I might possibly get back mm-hmm. from you? Mm-hmm. So somewhere there has to be that sell. And that's why I think getting, you know, first to trust you,
mm-hmm.
but also that to believe that you're capable mm-hmm. of creating value for mm-hmm. someone. Now, the more you do these kind of projects and the mm-hmm. more of a track record you have, mm-hmm. the easier mm-hmm. it is to make that sale.
Mm-hmm.
But you don't seem to, I wondered if you got more involved, but it sounds like you don't. It sounds like the initial go around is your credibility, yes. the center's
right.
credibility,
right.
all that drives, yes, you're being supervised by someone, but you're really not in the forefront of this.
No. And I for this particular project, that's how I played it out. A couple of things, Chuck. Lou and the three others were chosen from my class. I didn't choose everyone to do this project. So number one is I picked the top students, and it's my judgment whom I think can do it. The other thing I learned, and I had my failures too, the other thing I learned was students working in a team environment makes a big difference. So, you know, they compensate for each other. So, and I don't need to know how they interacted, but I know they were doing it well because I saw them, you know, twice a week.
Mm-hmm.
So getting the top students, getting them to work in teams, gives me that freedom to step back and sort of play this high level mentoring role. But at any point in time, if I run into a problem, then of course I will jump in.
Okay, so the people that might be thinking about doing work with you, well, they have the benefit of your experience just because, I mean, twice a week's a lot.
Right.
So you're visiting with people a lot.
Twice a week with the students.
With the students,
yeah,
I mean.
Absolutely. Oh,
right.
Yes.
But that's a lot of feedback.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And so you are engaged. You're just not out there with the client. You're just
right,
listening.
Right.
And then if something is disturbing at some level,
yes,
and would drive you to be there. Now, it's interesting you said you picked your top students, but I imagine it isn't just your smartest students on this.
Yes.
So it's more about, so what do you consider would be the criteria? I mean, obviously, this is like what makes for a good consultant. So what is the way you review that?
It's interesting, and I don't, if any of the students are listening in, they're going to get a chuckle out of it. These four students are the one who sort of were the loudest. They asked the most questions. They sat right in front. I mean, they were the most likable initially. You could see, you know, the kind of personality they had. They're always kidding around me. So I just felt these kids, I could throw them out, you know,
so
and they'll do it.
This kind of breaks the stereotype of the actuary,
yes,
then, right?
Yes. And so it took me, you know, maybe a semester, because this was in the second semester where I finally, you know, had a sense of students. It worked out very nicely.
Any other thoughts about this particular case beyond what Lewis told us about the case?
No, and I told you that, you know, you asked me earlier, what's my idea of success in a small, when you're doing a work like this? It's the time frame is a little bit short, even though I'm talking of risk and not failing, and failure is something that happened many years in the future. I'm talking of things that will have an impact over the next 3 to 5 years. Obviously, whatever report we put together is not going to be a report that's going to hold forever. And that's also the nature of small businesses. They're always changing, you know, new things happen. But it's a shorter time frame we look at, and small things, as we describe, where they can take action and get better results.
Well, one of the things I wanted to ask about, because, and I don't want to necessarily talk about the bagel case now, because this is more about sometimes what I find in a business setting, and of course maybe it's the lens that I look through when I'm looking at something, is there are often relationship issues with mm-hmm. key people in a firm, whether they're mm-hmm. they're joint owners or even if they're just, you know, the key person that does the work. You talked about risk in a small business is the key individual who has a set of knowledge that nobody else has,
yes,
that if that person's gone, they may not be the owner.
Yes.
But if that person's gone, the whole business is at risk, a major
Absolutely.
Risk. And so how do you deal with that person? And I'm not asking so much as to say, I know in certain instances, those people get treated unbelievably better than some of the people
yes.
who also work there. And that creates dysfunction in the workplace as well.
Yes.
And I also recognize that the person who's got this unusual gift of knowledge is not going to give it away, because they know if they give it away, they're no longer going to get that special
yes.
treatment, and they're not going to be worth what they're worth today, because somebody much junior for less money maybe can't do it exactly the way they could, but could learn to do it and the company could survive with it. So my question is more about the relationship piece
uh-huh.
and how your students might react to that, because certainly in the one we just heard about, it seems like the relationships only enhanced the willingness to grab and run with the ideas that came mm-hmm. from Lou and her peers. But if you've run into some relationship issues, then I would think it's more tricky for the students. And also, what's your role in any of that?
Yeah. And again, I think, to be fair, you know, there's maybe only so much we can hope to accomplish in this project. And you're raising some very good questions, and I think I'm going to learn along the way. Maybe the good thing is that we are dealing right now with fairly small businesses. And I said a small business could be up to 500 employees. I think when you get into larger small businesses, this becomes maybe a bigger problem. Most times it's fairly family-owned, or, you know, maybe a few trusted employees.
Right.
And, you know, there's certainly this constant or key man risk, what we call, where, you know, if something happens to one key person, you know, it could be a problem. But some of the issues of other people in the business, you know, being sidelined or having relationship problems, So far, you haven't experienced it yet because I think we've been dealing with relatively small businesses.
And Lou, let me ask this of you, because you work with a group of people. It sounds like Jay picked a really good team. It sounds like you got along well. But I've got to believe at some points there were disagreements along the way.
Yes.
How did those get resolved?
So we were tough questions.
that's why we're here.
yes, absolutely. While it was very great to have three of my other classmates with me to bounce ideas off of at all times, it was also difficult at times because obviously we're four different people, we have four different perspectives, so you know we're gonna have different ideas, and the way we resolve those difficulties, I think it's just like in any other situations. You know, we're all graduate students, we're trying to achieve the same goal, we're under the same mission to help these people, and it definitely helped tremendously when the owners were very willing to cooperate with us. We almost felt like it was our responsibility to help them get better because they were so nice and so open about everything. So whenever, you know, we kind of got angry at each other and then didn't know where to go, we would sort of just sit down and regroup and say things like, listen, we're just trying to help them get better, let's get past this, that's right. Write down or literally talk out the different ideas and the points that we have instead of talking passing each other. And the other very good resource that we have is obviously Professor Redivelu. So sometimes when we have disagreements, what we end up doing is we will write down all of the different points on different sides, and we would go to the professor, we would explain different sides, and we would say, hey professor, based on your knowledge and your experience, what do you recommend, what do you say is the best way to keep going with this thing? So you know, we were lucky to have sort of different resources at hand to help us resolve conflicts, and at the end of the day we were all classmates, we all knew each other, we were again under the same mission and the same goal, so that definitely helped a lot.
It's interesting. One of the things that I sometimes in workshop settings teach people is the idea of trying to look at how are we going to decide when we don't all agree.
Mm-hmm.
Before you get to a point where you don't all agree.
Right.
Because when you don't have that conversation ahead of time, sometimes you're not quite as fortunate as your group was, and you get stuck.
Right.
And you get angry, and it doesn't progress.
Yes.
And if you don't have one of the interesting ideas about a group like yours is to agree that we have somebody that if we can't all agree, mm-hmm. that we won't get mad at each other. What's important is we all feel like we all heard one another.
Right.
Everybody feels listened to and respected. No one's feeling disrespected.
Yes.
And when that's the case, nobody feels bad. Because there are different ways to get things done. There aren't always one choice about what's the right answer.
Mm-hmm.
And if we agree that if we escalate, in your case to you, Jay, mm-hmm. And then a decision gets made, we all say, okay, fine. And you just move forward and you keep going.
Yeah.
Other times, which is interesting, is to decide, you know, maybe we don't all have to agree.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe if it's not a critical choice,
mm-hmm.
but we disagree, and three out of four of us are leaning one way, we just go with it.
Yeah.
But even having a conversation about decision making just in the future and your teams and how they work together is a useful, from an emotional intelligence perspective, thing to do before you get to a place where you don't all agree.
See, I think with the students, I don't know whether this was a problem, and Lou might be able to explain that. When could they meet to talk about this? Because four different students not living together, living in different
right.
places. And getting them to meet, and all of them are taking classes, and this was going through exams and everything. And I told them we had to finish it, you know, by the end of the semester, maybe a week after finals, but that's about it. But so I had to push them to the deadline.
So imagine they could go into a chat room somewhere online.
I don't know what they did. they met at a bagel shop, maybe.
All right. So, but part of that is important about how do you make decisions? Because I know I've worked on project teams.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes it's so much easier to do something by myself than it is with colleagues. I mean, I welcome another set of eyes. I welcome a sharing of responsibilities.
Mm-hmm.
I welcome any time I've got people that are willing to be hardworking
mm-hmm.
and cooperative
mm-hmm.
And willing to share their ideas and listen to mine. Sometimes you don't find people who mm-hmm. happen to be mm-hmm. on your team that are quite like that, and
mm-hmm.
then things get much mm-hmm. more difficult
mm-hmm.
than they would be if you're doing it alone.
Mm-hmm.
So now you've had some experiences with other groups and other businesses. How about you talking a little bit about something that didn't work? I mean, do you have an experience where something, you know, just didn't work and something you might have learned from it? Any experiences like that?
On this particular thing?
In this kind of thing?
Yeah, actually, when I first started this whole risk management project, I didn't want to talk about it, but now they have brought it out. Mm-hmm. I bungled my way. I mean, and I've learned along the way. But I remember the first project I started off, I just couldn't complete it for a couple of reasons. One is I had this one student who was working on it, and I, you know, I have nothing against the student, but I think I've decided on this team approach. I think the student was by themselves, and I think they just couldn't put it together, and it was very difficult, to actually do this analysis. And I've learned, obviously, how to do this more effectively, and you know, I've written to this small business owner and told them that I'll redo the whole thing with them. But that was a failure, and I learned from it. And a couple of things was giving more structure. So these broad guidelines that I now provide to the students is pretty structured, enough for them to go with. And then, again, I didn't meet with the student as regularly as I did with these students.
And working
in a team. Because I think this student was really out on her own, and that made it difficult.
So more structure, more feedback, and a team approach.
Yes, absolutely.
Very interesting. So if people want to do something with your center, maybe this would be a good time to talk a little bit about how they contact you and what would be the criteria that you'd look for. You already told us that between 5 and 20 employees. Does it necessarily have to be in the Connecticut area? Are you willing to travel if somebody's willing to fund that?
Someone is willing, and I have the students. Yes, I will certainly, engage on this project. I think I'm willing to take a larger geographical location. Now, you mentioned this radio station. I would love to do an analysis if you guys are willing, and this would be a great opportunity.
There you go, Lou. We got the radio station as a candidate.
Risk analysis. I would love to do that. It's a cool place.
We'll talk.
But anyway, these are things like I've had others. Again, as word gets around what you're doing, a lot more people are now approaching me. I think there's one place which does own brewed beer. They wanted to talk to me. I said, that's great.
Yeah, I'll be a customer.
So, you know, it's interesting when you open it. But I think down the road, if I can put my little pitch going forward, I mean, it's great that we are doing this. It's, you know, it's certainly great for the students, great for the center, but it's still a small dent, I think, in what we can do for small businesses. I really think for this to become a larger scale, so we're doing it for free right now. I mean, we have a limited budget. I mean, I can support maybe a dozen projects per year just with the budget. But what if you're going to do something on a broader scale? I mean, I do think that, you know, maybe the larger corporations or even the larger small businesses, you know, might consider funding something like this, paying a nominal amount, because, you know, I do pay the students a nominal amount in any case. So that's all really I need to recover.
Okay. So how do they contact you, Jay?
Go to the UConn website, you know, and go to the mathematics department. I'm a faculty member there, and you'll get my website.
And then that takes you to the website.
Yes.
So the UConn, look under faculty, find Jay
Faculty Mathematics.
Faculty Mathematics.
Yes.
Okay. And then and then it connects to you.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
That sounds fine. Okay, I want to say thank you very much to Lou and to Jay for being here. It's been fun, partly because Jay's a friend, and I'm meeting Lou, and it's a pleasure, Lou. It's really nice to have you both here. Thank you very much for being on our show today.
Yes, thank you, Chuck.
Thank you.
You've been listening to the Emotion Roadmap, Take the Wheel and Control How You Feel. I hope you found that valuable, anybody that's a small businessman, and anybody that's an actuary out there that is looking to take on this idea of a noble goal. I think it's very admirable with the way Jay talked about that. You've been listening to the Emotion Roadmap. Take the wheel and control how you feel. Sometimes emotions are what's most important in our lives. It's the thing that are driving us to behave in certain ways that are very helpful, and at other times not so helpful. When it's not helpful, I encourage all of you to really ask yourself, if you're not feeling the way you want to feel and it's not serving you, what would be more ideal to feel? If you can answer that question, what would be more ideal to feel based on what you're trying to get done, everything else will solve itself. Once you've gotten in your mind what you want to feel, what you believe it's important to feel, you'll start answering yourself about how to make yourself feel that way. And I wish you a wonderful couple months, and thanks for listening.